It's really great to see so many of you here after what has been a very long and I'm sure rich and stimulating day. My name is Kristen Schultz, and I'm the director of the Global Coalition on Women and AIDS, and I'm delighted to be chairing this session tonight. Before we go any further, I just wanted to let you all know that there are thousands of people, potentially, in addition to all of you, watching this by webcast. Kaiser has chosen this session to be one of the sessions that they are webcasting all over the world. And for those of you who are watching on webcast, welcome. We hope that if you have questions and would like to interact with us on these issues, please contact the organizers, UNDP or UNAIDS, your local UNAIDS, UNDP, UNIFEM offices, or try to reach us at the global level. We're very happy to be having you with us. I'd also like to say a special word of thanks to the UNDP team that has organized and sponsored this session. And I think I would like to ask Nadia and Dina and Susanna to just stand up and let your faces be known. Thanks very much for all the work you've done to organize this event. So we've come together tonight to talk about the intersection of gender and AIDS and to share real practical experiences in the effort to incorporate gender into national responses on AIDS. I was meant to be co-chairing this session with Rebecca Greenspan, who's the regional director of UNDP for Latin America and the Caribbean, and she was going to be offering the opening remarks. She's been good enough to share her opening remarks with me, to share with you, because she unfortunately cannot be here. So the following remarks actually are coming from Rebecca. First of all, she says, you know, why are we here? Why is this discussion necessary? What's the point of having this? Why do we need to have this discussion? We know that 25 years into the AIDS epidemic, gender inequality and harmful gender norms continue to be major drivers of HIV. They're also major drivers to achieving universal access. We also know that approximately 60% of those who are infected with HIV in sub-Saharan Africa are women, and about 50% of those who are living with HIV worldwide are women. Research shows that intimate partner violence, challenges in negotiating safer sex, and other manifestations of gender inequality are closely associated with the risk of women becoming infected with HIV. But harmful gender norms and gender inequality not only affect a gender-specific risk of infection, they also mean that women and girls face barriers in accessing HIV services that are different barriers from those faced by men and boys. Therefore, understanding and addressing gender inequality is an essential aspect of grappling with the epidemic. A whole range of international agreements confirm the call for the elimination of discrimination and violence against women and girls. However, as we all know, these commitments are not yet reflected consistently in policies, programming, and funding priorities at the country level. Without a coherent gender analysis and a commitment to fostering the participation of women in vulnerable groups, as well as ensuring the meaningful participation of women and men who are living with HIV, We're just extremely unlikely to be able to end this epidemic. We also know that far too often, gender-related projects are small-scale, added-on, ad hoc, unsustainable, rather than being firmly rooted within national AIDS programs. Often, there's an insufficient connection made between analysis of the gender dynamics of the epidemic and the planning, budgeting, and monitoring of AIDS programs. This panel and our collective work, and our collective work is based on a commitment to ensure that gender equality agenda is fully integrated into the AIDS response. We see this as centering on three basic principles. First, knowing your epidemic in gender terms is probably the most essential key to effective programming. Second, focused and integrated action on gender is essential to directly address gender inequality in the context of AIDS and to increase gender sensitivity of all HIV policies and programs. And finally, mutually reinforcing action and reciprocal capacity building between those who work on HIV and those who work on gender inequality at the country level is critical to scaling up efforts on gender and AIDS. The speakers on this panel are important actors in these efforts. From their various perspectives from government and civil society, their work has touched on some of the core elements of intensifying gender integration. Let me introduce them to you, and then we'll proceed with the program. First of all, we have Fatma Mrisho, who is the Executive Chairman of the Tanzania Commission for AIDS. Next, we have Kusalya Parisamy, who is the President of the Positive Women's Network in India. Niridzai Gumbunzvande is the General Secretary of the Worldwide WCA. And Gary Barker is the Executive Director of Instituto Pro Mundo in Brazil. Our final speaker, who is not yet here, but we believe he's on his way, is Juan Jacobo Hernandez, who is the General Coordinator of Colectivo Sol here in Mexico. What we'll do is we'll go through each of the presentations one by one. We will not take questions or comments after each presentation, but we'll reserve all of the comments and questions for the period after everyone has spoken. So let's begin with our first speaker, who is Dr. Fatma Mrisho, Executive Chairman of the Tanzania Commission for AIDS. Dr. Mrisho has served as the United Nations Population Fund Resident Representative in Uganda. She has also worked with UNFPA in Ethiopia as a specialist in reproductive health training, as well as at the Ministry of Health in both Tanzania and Ethiopia. She will be discussing strengthening gender action through the National AIDS Response, Tanzania's experience. Dr. Mrisho.
Presentations. I'll start with the overview of Tanzania epidemic and the response, follow that with challenges, lessons learned, opportunities, and then the important question as to whether we should mainstream gender in HIV work or we should target gender interventions. I start by presenting the picture of what Tanzania epidemic is like. The prevalence of the infection in both sexes is 5.8, and this is a reduction from 7% in 2003 to the current 2007, which is now 5.8. For females, it is 6.8, and that's a reduction from 7.7, and males at 4.7, a reduction from 6.3. If you look at the bar chart, you do see the reduction, but one is tempted to feel that the reduction is more in males than it is in females. It's the reduction is a lot more in males than it is in females. Urban prevalence is a lot higher, almost twice as much as it is in rural areas, and we estimate to have about 2.5 million people living with HIV and AIDS, and about two-thirds of those are women. Looking at the higher risk sex in the past 12 months for males and females, looking at two variables, one is having more than two partners, and the other one is higher risk as defined by the survey in the past 12 months. And you can see that both is higher for the blue, which represents the males, than it is for the females, a lot higher. 40% of eligible women have been reached with PMTCT, quality is questionable, especially in terms of the four-pronged strategy as we know it. Most of it has tended to be using the mother to prevent the infection in the newborn and then forget about the mother. And I think this is a picture that we see probably in many countries. But mid-2008, about over 300,000 people were recruited into care and treatment countrywide. 63% of them were females and 47% males. And 60% are on ART are females and 40% are males. We thought it's important to share this information to show the differentials in the infection. If you get PrEP by age, it's quite obvious that it continues to be high in the younger ages in females, but it's almost at par and getting to a little bit higher in males in the older ages. And this is higher risk by education. The males who are blue, the rate of infection is almost the same, regardless of the age. But for women, it seems education detects a lot more than it does for men. What are the challenges? These are not in any particular order of priority, but one I think is an inadequate understanding of gender as a concept, including equity, equality. It is often seen in our communities as a foreign concept, currently threatening, and sometimes equated to justifying same-sex sex. Another challenge is a lot is said on gender and HIV, but the tools for addressing the situation are not so readily available or known to most policy and program staff. And that's a challenge to policymakers, technicians, to implementers. It does not appear to be a priority among many national and development partner stakeholders. And this is true for funders as well as for recipient countries. Traditional male-dominated gender relations and poor economic opportunities, especially for women, youth, stable persons, all impact negatively on the capacities of girls and women to determine and control their sexual relations, making the above-mentioned groups more vulnerable to the infection. There's inadequate sex and gender analysis of available information. National surveys, service statistics, and research data and information. Even where this information is available, not much is done in terms of sex differentiation, but even gender differentiation, and the two are different. The other challenge is that despite a dramatic increase in services related to HIV and AIDS, counseling testing, PMTCT, care and treatment, prevention, identification of the vulnerable and support, etc., the needs continue to outrun the supply. And the way I see it, in such an environment, gender focusing is viewed as a luxury and not a necessity. And we have to advocate a lot more than has been the case so far. Another challenge is deeply ingrained social gender norms. There is some improvement, but the improvement is slow. I'm giving some examples here. Polygamy is one. Serial monogamy is another. Life inheritance, widow cleansing, female genital cutting or mutilation, whichever way we want to call it. Initiation, preparation for womanhood by inserting fingers and by using different men to make sure that the opening is wide enough for you to be a woman. And this is done to children. Treatment for infertility, this is something that we just realized in Tanzania recently. And what happens here is that a group of infertile women probably with their authority, certainly with the authority of the husband, in a particular community of about 2 million people, they would go to a special prayer, and this prayer is actually an overnight dance, 2-3 nights, and then they would have an orgy with several men who've been requested to abstain for a couple of days, and fed very well for the job, and then it's you know, free for all. Some do conceive, and that makes it, because infertility has a lot of stigma, people continue to agree to undertake this exercise because they would rather do that than remain infertile. Male decision making in reproductive health, including testing or not testing, care and support, and even breastfeeding or not breastfeeding. High stigma, often more addressed to females accused of witchcraft, is a ploy for inheritance of husband's welfare and money. Concerns, these are concerns as I see them. The impact on women of the knowledge that male circumcision is protective. And we often do not, we don't say male circumcision, we just say circumcision. And that has its own dangers for the woman. Men having sex with men getting most of the attention, and not so for females having anal sex. And this is something that I hope this conference will take very seriously. I think MSM is stealing the agenda in terms of means of transmission of HIV/AIDS. What matters is the anal sex. And women do have anal sex, and they have just as much chances of getting infection as the men, but one never hears of them. Addressing many of the gender issues requires also addressing basic rights for accessing quality education, health, shelter, water, etc. And these are mostly unaffordable and or slow pace in resources-limited countries and communities. Sexual violence, abuse is a cause of consequence of HIV infection, and I have quoted Stephen Lewis' statement there, which I will pass very quickly since I'm already over my time. What are the practices and lessons learned? The National Strategic Framework was drawn using a skilled, gender-qualified person. Therefore, from the strategies to the indicators, they helped us through that. National HIV and AIDS-related surveys, we now have requested all surveys should devote a chapter on gender, deliberate chapter on gender. The other good practice is that a national that was led by the president tested 4.3 million people. And in so doing, it advocated that men and women have the responsibility to test. A lot more women tested. Unfortunately, some men, there are anecdotes of some men saying, you go and test. Whatever your results, then I'll know my own status. So they did not go. And it also, a couple of men also tested and didn't go back for their results. And we need to know what fears men have, just as much as what opportunities women should have. Opportunities, we have a positive constitution that recognizes equal rights. We have positive gender policies, a very gender-convinced president who won a global award recently in recognition for his gender sensitivity. A vibrant Tanzania gender networking group which invented gender budgeting and developed the tools for gender budgeting. We have positive discrimination in education and parliament, decision-making councils, and AIDS committees. Commitment to attaining primary reduction to reduce HIV infection from 7% to 5% by 2010, as per MDG. We were required to respond to the question, should we have a dedicated action on gender or should it be mainstreamed? And these are some of the thoughts that I thought I would share. The two must complement each other. They are not mutually exclusive. In situations where gender is not or poorly understood or opposed, dedicated action should take the lead, but the two should coexist. Gender mainstreaming should be paired with dedicated action, starting with areas less resistance, for example, access to preventive information and care, vulnerability assessment, risk reduction, orphans care and support. Thank you for your attention, and sorry for going over time.
Dr. Mauricio, thank you very, very much. Let's move along to our next speaker. I would now like to invite Ms. Kusalia Parasamy to give her remarks. Ms. Parasamy is the president of the Positive Women's Network in India. In 1995, she was married at the age of 21 and within months was diagnosed with HIV. 7 months later, her husband died of AIDS. Since then, she has created a nationwide grassroots care and support network for HIV-positive women in India called the Positive Women's Network, or PWM+. She works to end discrimination of HIV-positive women in all spheres, to improve access to HIV and AIDS prevention information, and to provide care and support to women and their families suffering from HIV and AIDS. Today, she will discuss empowering positive women and strengthening leadership and capacity of women's networks for a more effective AIDS response. Yes, you can.
Do some. Hello. Hello. I can stand. No, no problem. I can sit. Good evening, everybody. I can share with whatever the skills and we gain it through the positive women groups. So like I can give you some information and what we gain in through the nine and a half years. With the support of so many people, and often we get the support from UNIFEM and other UN agencies, and we I can share with for like first we started with a group in 1998, and with a few women of women living with HIV, within the common network, we feel that women voices should be heard about and then should be addressed, and then also like we needed in the platform for women to discuss and our issues, and then we needed in the support system for within ourselves. So that's why we formed in 1998. And we did our visioning exercise in 2004. In India is very big country. We did in the region wise in our visioning exercise. We came up with the vision as all women living with HIV, and then affected the children and to empower and live a dignity life, and equality and free from stigma discrimination. And this is our vision, and women should involve, and we needed should involve ourselves. We needed in the capacity to involve ourselves. So we are doing it. We are doing it our 10th year celebration in November, and for involvement of women living with HIV. We want to see our involvement in the national programs, and then in the state level program, and then in the district level program, and how we can able to contribute in ourselves. Like that, we needed some of the skills to, I can give you on the back, after my things, the information. We have in more than 5,000 women living with HIV in the part of the network, and we are working in 9 states, and we have the 9 states in the groups, and then also in the districts we have in 52 districts we have the groups, and in all the women we are doing in the some way in this through the support group meeting. First we wanted in all the women should come to the some level sharing, and that's a platform for support group meeting, and that support group meeting will help other women to go to the different level of skills. So that one of the skills today I'm sharing with you, the leadership skills, that we did in the program. first program and we did in the nationally in 2002, and first time we met it in all the country together and all the women together. This platform is created in the joint UN program and mainly in the UNIFEM, and that's like first initially like we want to know about our issues and who we can partner with it, and then how we can work it out. So that we discussed in 2002, it's sharing the new reality. So that's the first discussion. And then like after that, we follow up it on that in the some of the program are supported by some of the agency like UNIFEM, and then in the other partners, women's group, women's movement. And they build it in the capacity to ask for, to understand the CEDAW. And we know our rights are often violated and then discriminated. So first we want to know about all the treaties, and then what is all the treaty means, like how we can give the report and everything we understand. And then we did the study. And that's helped in our groups to work on the rights-based approach. So, like we have some of the women are trained in all the treaties and then rights in our own Indian's laws, and then all the like how the functioning of in the laws and systems. That's helped in the women to know about our rights, and then we given the report to the CEDAW also, in the shadow with the CEDAW committee of in the India groups in the women groups. On the follow up, and we did also in the legal literacy workshop for women. So during that time, and women are able to raise the voices. For some of the services are accessed in the women. And 2004, we did the second national consultation. We wanted, and HIV is not only the one department issue. HIV is in the all the department issue. Like in India, the HIV is in the National AIDS Control Society issue, not in other department. Like we have in. A number of department is working for different causes. So all the departments should respond to the HIV, not only the HIV department. So through that, like we learned about what the department is doing in each department. We selected in 9 department, and the 9 department is working closely with the women. So like we invited in 9 department. We understand in how the system is working. And then we are able to rise in our voices. So all the things are in the skill. Like we developed in our own skills, and after that only we are rising it as other person in the hierarchy in the voices. So through that, and we learned and we raised it. So that's the process we did. And that's with the help of other women's groups. Like so many women's groups also involved with it. To helping our process. And still, like, whatever we having, still we have the challenges to build up our skills, because we are in the rural area, and so many languages in India, its official language itself, like 26, and so many languages. Like we had to build the capacity for so many people, so many women, and they had to come up, and we had to translate in many languages. So then only we can able to articulate, and they can able to raise their voices. And nationally, like all the people are nationally and internationally, they can speak only the one language in English. So the women in the rural area, they cannot what is the policies and what is the programs and everything. So that should be come to the locally languages. So that's a challenge for us. And then also the challenges in the resources to build the women leadership. Like I was in the fellowship. Through that, and I gained a lot of knowledges. And I'm also like in the 2009, and I cannot able to speak in one single word in English. I can able to share with you now through all the skills. So many people are given to me, and the same skills the women needed, and continuously needed. Not like one time we given the training, that's it. So women needed for continuously skills building. So then only they can able to they can able to articulate, and they can able to share their like whatever the pains are they gone through it, so they can able to give the shape to the programs in the HIV programs. So like the women involvement is very important. Women living with HIV involvement is very important. So that is like often like we can able to share in the program, in national level program, in some level. They are not taking up in the top level, so that's a lacking still, because we can able to raise our resources, very little resources, and we can through NS National Plan 3 we did in the sharing and some level, and because of that in some like little bit like in the gender issues are put in. But there is no resource allocation, and recently they are discussing about in the gender policy. In the 3-1 is affecting lot to the program, and particularly for the women program, because one policy, one framework, and one national level coordination mechanism, the people are understanding in a different way. So that's itself affecting for the women program. So that is like the always women are checked out in the national level. The framework, whatever the framework are, it's checked out often. So that's also one of the challenges. And like I want to request you, like one of the thing is like women leadership is one final thing is like I want to share to you. The women groups is needed in each countries, and then in not only the country level, in the local level. So that is needed. That should be kept. Resources should be allocated. I'm not saying in the money resources alone, should be given the capacity to run the groups, and then to run the things like we are. Not able to receive any the global fund money, any women group. So that's itself lacking. So like often the like 8th round is for gender, but in the capacity building is not happened to the women group. So because of that, we are not able to receive any resources. And like we needed in the capacity building, and then also like the leadership should be strengthened, and leadership should be not one time in the leadership program. It should be continue the programs, and that's designed by the women itself, not in the somebody in the like college or somebody. We needed in those people's skills, but should be consultant with us, with the women leaders. So then it will be good program will be, we can receive it. So that's my final thing. Thank you for the opportunities.
Thank you very much, Kusalia. Our next speaker is Ms. Niridzai Gumbunsvanda. She is the General Secretary of the World YWCA. She has over 10 years of experience with the United Nations, where she has served as regional director for the UNIFEM in Eastern Africa. She's also served as a human rights officer with UNICEF, as well as a national child rights advisor in Liberia and Zimbabwe, respectively. For many years, she has worked in the women's rights movement on issues of constitutionalism, inheritance, property, and land rights. Nyiridzai has also served as interim coordinator for the Zimbabwe Women Lawyers Association during its formative stage and in the Ministry of Justice and Constitutional Affairs in Zimbabwe. She holds a master's degree in private law. She will be addressing tonight increasing women's participation in decision-making processes and AIDS coordination mechanisms. Nyiridzai.
Thank you so much, Christine. Last night, speaker after speaker recognized the U.S. government and the reauthorization of PEPFAR, and I equally congratulate the U.S. government. What I didn't hear was a standing ovation for the millions of grandmothers and grandfathers who wake up every day to put food on the table. What I didn't hear is that woman living with disability closed in the heart because of the stigma on disability and who is being raped, and yet she has two kids and she's trying to find food for these children. She may be positive and we may never know. We didn't give a standing ovation to the 19-year-old widow living positively with HIV and AIDS and doing everything she can to prevent the spread of HIV and AIDS. We're just saying it's crucial that the voices of the ordinary women who have specific experiences find itself on the content of decision making, but they also find themselves on the tables of decision making. I'm quite happy that the organizers have given me 8 minutes to talk about women in the context of gender, and not to talk about gender, but to talk about women. That, for me, gives a good spin. For women, I think there are three conceptual clarities that I would recommend for the national aids, for the countries, for the communities, for the international community, for all of us, on what is crucial. At the conceptual level, we need to invest in empowerment. What are the actions that provide empowerment for the leadership of women? Empowerment is about knowledge, skills, capabilities, and opportunity. We already know that women are marginalized, disadvantaged, less educated, and everything. Therefore, that calls for an empowerment approach. It means a national AIDS policy must have an empowerment approach, especially for women and girls, because our analysis is telling us that women are disempowered. Secondly, at the conceptual level, we must have a rights approach. A rights approach starts from the premise that women and girls, just as much as men and boys, are citizens with rights, are citizens with obligations to contribute their knowledge, their perspective, and their experience into the running of their country and into defining their future. They are also entitled, women and girls, just as much as men and boys, are entitled to share of resources with regards to the response on HIV and AIDS, and that their rights must be protected. And therefore, an AIDS response which takes the issue of leadership and women and puts it at the center must naturally have violence against women indicators in its framework, because it is a rights approach, and rights are about protection. The third is about security. We know that there's been a broader focus on the concept of security from a more militaristic kind, but we have to talk about human security. In the context of HIV and AIDS, participation of women and their leadership is about human security. It's about livelihoods, it's about securing knowledge, including indigenous knowledge within our communities, in order to inform the kind of responses that we need to HIV and AIDS. One of those knowledges is what my mother had before she passed on 2 years ago after she had buried four of her children. The knowledge which she shared with us is that the primary decision making about HIV and AIDS is a personal decision making, and it's a family decision making, and it's a community, and a relational, and a government is a facilitator to provide services and knowledge. But decision making, therefore, in AIDS response must start with empowering women to make decisions at the personal level, at the household level, at the community level, in understanding the relationships within their community. That is the knowledge which I understand from my mother. And that, I think, is the knowledge of what HIV and AIDS response is also about. That is multiple levels of decision making, which in itself is facilitated by the governance institution and serviced by access to resources. The second point that I have is, where are decisions made at the macro level? At the moment, our AIDS responses are informed by certain key global principles and are supported also within a framework of key global decisions. The first decision is that our governments are taking the lead in the response to HIV and AIDS, and therefore the three ones principle: one national authority and one program, one monitoring and evaluation framework, and one budget. And therefore, it means we need to integrate the perspective and participation of women in these three ones in a concrete, monitorable way. Participation in the national authority, monitoring and evaluating indicators with regards to gender equality, and targeted resources to reduce gender inequalities or empower women within the AIDS framework, so that the gender equality issues are not only in the analysis, but they are actually permeating through the three ones. Again, we know that at times in a number of countries, in most countries, the AIDS policy does not speak to the gender policy and to the finance policy. We need a clear involvement of the ministries of gender, and for that coherence of gender policies and AIDS policies and finance policies to inform the priority for the leadership of women, but also inclusion of gender equality issues. Why this is important is because the issue of resources is crucial. Thirdly, just around resources, is some decisions are made at a global level, especially in developing countries where our governments have to negotiate. They have to negotiate the poverty reduction strategy, which is the context within which we are responding to HIV and AIDS. And some of the poverty reduction strategies have huge transactional pressures on the communities. They've been participatory, and that's good. And we would like to see how much that the poverty is reducing. So we need to look at the PRSPs as part of the AIDS response and not look at them separately. Again, we need to know that our governments are negotiating for accessing the big vertical funds, and it's tough. They have to negotiate the global fund, set up a country coordinating mechanism, which at times the YWCAs of this world cannot even access. They have to find ways of working with other NGOs, faith groups, to even have their sentence in their project proposal to be put into a CCM. It's so complicated for the community-based groups to be in the CCM for the Global Fund. And when you go to that Global Fund, it's like 6-7 steps before the approval process. And so the issue of decisions for resources are in the Global Fund together with the government. And yet that is where Mama Salome, who is blind and living positively, has to have their issues prioritized. Decisions are made in the discussions with the U.S. government to access the PEFA Fund. How, therefore, are the women's leadership within the PEFA Fund in the U.S. government, how are the U.S. taking the gender issues much more substantive? How gender sensitive is PEFA, and to the extent also of the accountability? World Bank is a MAP program, a multi-country program targeting Africa. What is also the participation of women or inclusion of gender equality? We are saying accountability to gender equality and women's participation must be reflected by tangible, quantifiable monitoring indicators within the national AIDS frameworks. Concrete reduction in early marriages. Concrete issues which we can say the incidence of violence against women is reduced. We are also saying that we monitor through gender responsive budgeting and positive allocation of resources. Lastly, we are at the International AIDS Conference. And if we look, the YWCA sits in the co-coordinating committee of the International AIDS Conference. It has been tough for us to negotiate having one or two women on plenary. But there are so many women in the world who are scientists, who are professors, who are knowledgeable, who can actually also be very active. But just look in your books and you see that the disproportionate participation of women as knowledge providers, as policymakers, and that for us is just an example when we say we need also a greater involvement of women. Lastly, it's all about the household. Whatever we do, change has to happen at the household level. I hope in my generation we will not have many other Nyaradzais who would be able to see the city lights when they are already 20 years and you have to ask somebody to hold my hand to walk the streets of Harare. And that in itself projects you to a lot of pressure of negotiating life, negotiating relationships, negotiating how to succeed, how to be. We simply are emphasizing the point that Kusalia has raised. We have to look at the issue of participation from a diversity of experiences of women. Women living with HIV and AIDS, women with disabilities, but also I would do a disservice without emphasizing one point for which I have half a minute. We must, as a matter of urgency, because it's universal action now, talk about HIV and AIDS in crisis situations. It is complicated because of the violence, because of the abuse, but it is also complicated because of the nature of the governance institutions you have in crisis countries. It is complicated when we see that we need different policy approaches. What home-based care approach? Us as the YWCA, we are there in the Sudan. We are there in my own country in Zimbabwe. We are there in the DRC. We struggle on what is a home-based care approach when there's no home. When you are in a refugee camp in Darfur and or in DR Congo and you are displaced and you have received multiple displacement, what is that home and community-based care? I'm simply raising the issue that women's experiences of providing care or prevention in a crisis context demands that women have to be at the table to share the challenges of having to deal with the whole emotional, physical, and extension of health-related support in crisis countries, because it is traumatizing and it is tough. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Nyaradzai. I don't know if anybody else is noticing something funky with the lights going on, but I guess it's being taken care of. Let's hope that the PowerPoint works. Our final speaker, I think that our other speaker is perhaps not showing up. So our final speaker tonight is Mr. Gary Barker, who is the executive director of Instituto Promundo, a Brazilian NGO that works locally and internationally to promote gender equity and reduce violence against women, children, and youth. He has coordinated research and program development on engaging men and boys in gender equality in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, and has served as a consultant to the World Bank, WHO, USAID, UNAIDS, UNICEF, UNFPA, and the government of Brazil. Mr. Barker holds a doctorate in child development. Tonight he will be discussing enrolling men and boys in promoting gender equality as a key element in addressing HIV. Gary?
Is that it? There we go.
Well, I hope I'm not expected to do cleanup at the end of the session in talking about this question of what to do about men and boys. But that is the question. I think as we've heard the presentations here, as we think about what we normally mean in talking about gender and HIV/AIDS, much of it has been about making collective noise about the harm that has been done to women and girls around the world, whether the individual behavior or the collective behavior of men in far too many settings. And I think, to me, both as we look at HIV/AIDS, as we look at gender-based violence, as we look at other forms of violence in the world, one of the questions that we have to say is it possible to question and change versions of manhood that are based on dominance, based on using power over others, based on not caring, based on the lack of empathy? Is it possible to promote change? I think there's a lot of skepticism rightfully out there about what can be done with men and boys. And I think the questions then for me that become driving for the work that we do as an organization and we as a group of NGOs and some UN agencies trying to drive forward some work around men and boys is, why does this work matter? Why does engaging men and changing masculinities matter for HIV/AIDS prevention? And I think the crucial question of, can men and boys change? We know that resources are scarce. We know how difficult it has been in many settings and still is to engage men in this work. Is it possible to promote change? And is it possible, I think there's also a time issue, as we listen to the stories that we've heard so far tonight, is it possible that men and boys and masculinities can change fast enough to make a difference for those, for this generation, living in the face of HIV/AIDS? It's far too late in the day to make a long list of the data. You've seen it. We've seen it today. We'll hear about it in the next days. We know, in terms of the figures related to HIV/AIDS, that men's behavior, men's power in sexual relationships is key to the HIV trends that we see in many countries. We know that when we've had success stories, much of that has been about changing the behavior of some groups of men out there. I mentioned here Thailand, Brazil, Uganda, perhaps. We know that in focused epidemics in some countries, in concentrated epidemics, that the behaviors of key groups of men make a difference. Men in the military, men who migrate for work, among others. We saw data already here from Tanzania, and that is repeated across many countries, that men are less likely than women to seek services, to seek VCT, to seek ARVs when they're available, and that men are less likely to provide care for members of the family who are living with HIV/AIDS. That said, I think it's important to say it's not about individual men that this change is going to happen, but it's about the way that manhood is constructed, or about the way that masculinities are constructed. The social norms about what it means to be men around the world, I think, are the key entry points around HIV/AIDS. It is, to me, the social circumcision, perhaps, in this field. We know in numerous sample surveys that we have that men's and boys' attitudes related to what it means to be men, whether they think manhood is about sexual conquest, about non-condom use, about sex as being based on daring and risk-taking, about sex as a way to affirm their manhood, that those constellations of attitudes are related to whether men use violence against women, the number of sexual partners they have, their rates of reported STI symptoms, their condom use, whether they use substance or alcohol. In sum, the extent and to which how much men buy into a rigid, sexist version of masculinity has everything to do with the vulnerabilities that women and girls face and men's own vulnerabilities in terms of HIV/AIDS. And I think it's important to affirm that. It may seem obvious, but that it's not about blaming or pointing the finger at a number of individual men. That is important in some cases to hold individual men accountable. But as we look at trying to promote large-scale change, it has to be about changing this collection of norms. So back to my question, can men and boys change? There is a lot of change going on already out there. In spite of that's happened even before we've begun to design programs out there, there's a lot of us influenced by a generation of women's rights activism, by feminist movements that are making a difference in legislation. We heard examples from Tanzania. We've seen those in Brazil, much of Latin America. There is progressive legislation out there. Many of us have grown up next to or with partners or mothers involved in trying to change what it means to be women. And we're seeing some men begin to react to that. We're seeing generations of boys and men who are open to some degrees of change. It's not a linear kind of change. There's often what we hear in men's and boys' voices is a partial acceptance of some of that change, but at the same time feeling like they've got to live up to these rigid notions of manhood that their peers, their brothers, their fathers, their uncles, and others think they may have to do. But I think the issue then is not if men can change. They're changing all the time. To me, the question is how fast, and can we speed up that change? This is a chart that you don't have to make sense of at the moment, but just in a sentence or two, if I can, we've been working with World Health Organization to review the evaluation data that's out there for interventions that have been working with men and boys in the area of health promotion and HIV/AIDS prevention. We've identified 57 programs that had some reasonably rigorous evaluation data, and of those, you can see in the green, yellow, and red here, and the kinds of interventions there's a reasonable amount of data that suggests that well-designed interventions with men and boys, whether group education or offering services for men, community outreach, campaigns, or some integrated versions of those, there's reasonable evidence in small-scale interventions in short amounts of time that men, in fact, will change their behaviors. They'll use condoms at higher rates. They'll use services at higher rates. They'll become more involved in providing caregiving activities. They will reduce in some cases, yes, we even have evidence, they'll reduce their use of violence against women. The question is whether we can scale these up. And the data that we looked at here, about 25% of those programs showed evidence of behavior change. About 40%, 38.5% of those showed evidence of attitude change, and about 37%, it was unclear. Certainly there was knowledge change, but not clear enough evidence yet of attitude and behavior. That's not a bad start. The point is, these are quite small-scale studies, and I say small-scale. Some of them have reached sample sizes of 2,000 men. That is quite small as we look at countries the size of India. That is quite small as we look at the size of the epidemic that we're talking about. What is key to these interventions is not simply that they're saying, men, come in the door. Men, these messages are for you. The interventions that showed the highest rate of effectiveness were those that took as their starting point questioning these social norms about manhood. Not simply offering condoms in new colors in new places. Those things are important, making sure they're available, making sure services are there, but saying it's about questioning these rigid, homophobic, sexist, and violent versions of manhood. For time, I'm not going to go into too many of some of the individual studies, but just to give you a sense that our conclusion from this is about making gender equality, safer sex, and nonviolence part of particular younger men's, boys and men's, identities. It's not simply hammering with AIDS messages, but saying there are advantages to you and to those around you if you look at different ways of being men. These are not ways of being men that are being imported from someplace. These are men in the communities saying we, as men from these communities, want to promote change. And just to give you some examples of images of what that looks like. I'm not going to go into any of the individual studies that we've done, because we don't have time this evening. There are some studies that I'll leave available on the table there for those who are interested. But to sum up, I think what this small but important base of experience is saying, we need to work with important groups of men to enable them to question these traditional, rigid versions of manhood. It's not about questioning all the meanings of what it is to be a man. There's lots of things about what it means to be a man that are quite positive. It's about finding those that are positive and holding them up, but questioning the ones that cause harm. It is also about finding entry points that men feel that they're not being criticized or attacked, or that they're going to be kind of bashed as they walk in the door, but to say there are good things for you if you are willing to talk about these forms of change. Some colleagues here in Mexico did a video that they called, in Spanish, it was ¿Qué ganamos en cambiar? It was a series of interviews with men. In English, that would be, what do we gain by changing? And I think it's important, and our work has also been about saying men gain from this change as well. It's not always obvious to men how they gain from that change, but they have come to see that violence doesn't produce good for them, that relationships based on dominance and power don't feel good to them, that most men find that consensual sex with a partner about whom one also is concerned about his or her sexual pleasure is more interesting than simply treating your sexual partner as an object. Most men come to see that that is interesting to think about. Many men, in the images that I included here, many men can see something quite obvious about positive interactions with children. And that's often the easiest point that we can engage some men for whom fatherhood is a reality. It's also clear that there's no one-size-fits-all for this work with men, that we have to talk about poverty and social class, unemployment issues, urban and rural differences, and lots of others, that this work is not simply there's one kind of intervention that we can replicate across the world. It's also clear that we've got to integrate this, as we've learned in interventions with women, that it's about income empowerment, right to inheritance, legal protections, as well as helping women think about new ways of asserting what they want to do and what they want out of life. The work with men also has to be integrated across those areas. It's also got to be clear that this work is not about some small group of men who might define themselves as heterosexual over here, or a small group of men over here who might define themselves as homosexual, bisexual, or same-sex attracted. It is about working together to question these violent and homophobic and sexist versions of masculinity. It's not about dividing men into these categories, but finding the collective gains that we have in promoting the change. Final point, then, is, again, to look beyond the individual. So much of this work has been about pointing the fingers at individual groups of men. There are moments when perhaps that's important, but it is about changing how we raise boys from the very earliest ages. I think it is quite important to say it's not simply some new messages out there, some interesting interventions, but it is about the very real structural changes to create masculinities that are based on empathy and caring and nonviolence. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Gary, and thank you to our entire panel for sharing your very rich and stimulating presentations. What I'd like to do now is open up for a discussion period. I think that before we actually take some questions, Susanna Fried from UNDP would like to make a comment. Susanna?
Thank you. Okay. I'm going to turn this way if you'll allow me. What I wanted to say is that often we have these really wonderful discussions, but it's not always clear where that goes and what kind of follow-up there is to that. In this case, I'm really happy to say that there's a fairly concrete place where this discussion can go. We and the UNAIDS family are in the process of developing gender guidance for more effectively integrating gender into the national AIDS response. And so this discussion, along with many other discussions that we're having, actually helps us do that in a way that is better and more precise and takes into consideration a larger number of perspectives. So we really appreciate this discussion, and we really will take it into our process of putting that together. And in that sense, I also want to say that beyond here, if people would like to communicate with us, we do have an address, and it is AIDSgender@undp.org. AIDSgender@undp.org. And so if you have ideas afterwards that you'd like to share with us, we invite you to send us your comments, and we look forward to a continuing conversation. And with that, let's hear what y'all have to say.
Thanks, Susanna. I will invite some questions and comments from the floor. I believe that Marta Val from UNIFEM would like to make a first comment.
I'm trying to speak in English. As this, is it any problem if I speak in Spanish? Yeah. Well, okay, I'll try to speak in English.
Feel free to speak in Spanish. There are okay. Translators.
Bien, pues entonces sí que me va a ser más fácil, voy a sentirme más confortable hablando en español. Pues bien, primero quiero dar las gracias al panel por las intervenciones que nos han ofrecido y desde UNIFEM como parte de la familia de Naciones Unidas y siguiendo con el trabajo que ha mencionado recientemente Susana, en el que se están haciendo pues bueno, toda una serie de lineamientos para dar una respuesta al VIH-Sida con un enfoque de género, pues por parte de UNIFEM sí que nos queríamos referir a el trabajo que hemos realizado y que se ha materializado en la publicación que titulada Transforming National AIDS Response y que creo recoge pues las ideas fundamentales que se han dicho en este panel. El marco de derechos humanos de las mujeres está dado desde hace muchos años. Acá se ha hablado de la SEDAO, la necesidad de transversalizar con un enfoque de género a todos los niveles y en todos los sectores. La respuesta nacional al VIH-Sida también se ha dado y creo que desde el año 95 con la Plataforma de Acción de Beijing se nos dio un buen mapa de ruta. Y el otro punto fundamental que creo que se ha dado en el panel ha sido la necesidad de contar con los hombres y los hombres jóvenes en la lucha contra el VIH-Sida. El trabajo de género no solamente supone trabajar con las mujeres, sino la necesidad imperiosa de poder contar con estos cambios en la masculinidad dominante. Y finalmente, quizá desde el trabajo de base y a nivel comunitario con el que se hablaba de la necesidad de contar con las demandas desde la comunidad, se habla muchísimo de la necesidad de transversalizar con el enfoque de género la respuesta nacional al VIH, la necesidad de contar con las demandas de las mujeres, si bien a la hora de ver las políticas que quizás se diseñan y se implementan, pues quizá los dos modelos principales o imperantes de mujer que se ofrecen son pues como grupo clave trabajadoras sexuales y como otro grupo clave madres. Es más, creo que a lo largo de una etapa de la vida se puede ser mujer, niña, joven, trabajadora sexual y a la vez madre, trabajadora sexual y a la vez abuela, o directamente madre o no madre, y nada más. Entonces, creo que a la hora de diseñar una respuesta realmente con un enfoque de género o contar con las demandas de las mujeres, sí deberíamos considerar que el ser mujer es un amplio abanico de maneras. Y finalmente, pues quiero retomar, el marco de derechos humanos de las mujeres está dado, las evidencias en las intersecciones entre violencia contra las mujeres y la feminización de la pandemia creo que están dadas. Necesitamos, yo creo, compromiso, voluntad política y sobre todo financiamiento. Compromiso con presupuestos, sobre todo en el contexto en el que nos encontramos, las nuevas arquitecturas, la nueva arquitectura de la ayuda en la que en todo el proceso ni en Monterrey, ni en Doha, ni en París, y no estoy muy segura de si en Ghana vamos a estar representadas. Ese es el reto. Gracias.
Thank you very much, Marta. I saw Aditya and then Cynthia. Oh, well, okay, Cynthia.
It's very hard to know what direction to face without being rude to someone. Thank you all for your wise comments. My name is Cynthia Rothschild. Let me turn now. And I'm an independent consultant. I'm based in New York, and I work primarily with women's human rights organizations, HIV organizations, and lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender organizations. And I want to make a comment that might be, it's hard. I'm about to say something, and forgive me if I blunder my way through this, but I think that we're facing a hard moment when gender and sexism and homophobia are meeting in a pool, and we're struggling to figure out the right way out of that pool. When we talk about agendas in terms of HIV, I think there's a very simple bottom line, and that's that we're all struggling for too few resources. That is the bottom line, whether we're talking about MSM or whether we're talking about gender or women and girls, we're fighting for a pie of resources that is too small. And I think what's happening is that there are these flare-ups, these moments where it seems like people in marginalized groups are somehow pitted against one another, fighting for that too small set of resources. So I think for me, what I'm calling for myself and for all of us, I think, to help think through is how we can have movements so that the MSM movement or gay men or transgender people, I want increased understandings of the nuances of women's lives and girls' lives and the ways in which we live with violence on a daily basis and we grapple with gender discrimination on a daily basis. And I also want an understanding from women's rights advocates that can allow for acknowledgement and understanding that gay men and lesbians and bisexual and transgender people are also marginalized, also persecuted, also judged, and sometimes killed, not only because of their identity, our identity, but also because of our relationship to HIV, whether it's real or perceived HIV status. So ultimately, the call here is for nuanced dialogue and better ways of strategizing with one another so that we can, I mean, we're fighting the same obstacle, and that's that the resource pool is just too small. So that's my comment. Thank you. Thank you for giving me the floor.
Thanks very much, Cynthia.
Can I start?
Turn whatever direction you want.
Yeah, sure. Hi, everybody. My name is Aditya Bandopadhyay. I work with the Asia Pacific Coalition on Male Sexual Health. I want to thank Gary Baker for your presentation because you have laid out the problem. And the problem is masculinity. The whole of this gender debate is actually needs to be and should be informed by how masculinity is perceived, how masculinity is manifested, and how masculinity is actually a cause of oppression. And if we know that bottom line, I think a lot of the solutions that we all are seeking would become easier. I also want to thank the lady from YWCA for her presentation, for the simple basic fact that you have highlighted about the universality of rights, that it is not competing rights between men and women, boys and girls, but that it is rights for everybody and optimization of rights for everybody. And Kaushalya, more power to you as always. I love you. I want to talk very briefly about the UNDP gender guidelines, which Susanna also mentioned a little while back. I was fortunate enough to actually attend the consultation meeting that was at the root of the formulation of that guidelines. And what informed the formulation of that guideline was the understanding that masculinity is a problem, that violence is manifested by how masculinity is perceived, and therefore we have to address masculinity, and to do that we have to also include all of those population segments that are actually affected and that are targeted and that are violated by these understanding of masculinity. And from that understanding stemmed the inclusion of transgenders and sexual minorities in that UNDP document. What happened afterwards is a disaster and a shame. A very limited group of women's organizations actually opposed the inclusion of transgender and sexual minorities in that documentation. The United States government supported those few women's organizations, while there was a vast number of other women's organizations that we have consulted with that are part of this very process who do appreciate and support the inclusion of transgender and sexual minorities in that UNDP document. But ultimately, the final call, the buck stops with the very upper echelons of UNAIDS, and there they failed us, which I consider to be a singular unconscionable failure of the UN system as far as this document is concerned. Having said that, I just want everybody to park that thought. I would come to something that Dr. Mauricio mentioned about mainstreaming anal sex. We all want that. We all want that. I bring it up specifically because you also mentioned about the Tanzanian president and his gender sensitivity and the award that he has received in that regard. But you also mentioned something about competing resources vis-a-vis MSM and gender issues. I agree with your postulate. I don't agree with your language, and I want to, like, you know, protest that bit. The day the Tanzanian president allows postering in the streets of Tanzania that says, use condoms for anal sex, irrespective of whether the anus is of a man or a woman, I will understand your competing priority argument here. Till that date, somebody who represents the system that exists in Tanzania, whose homophobia we actually are, we are aware of the homophobia of sub-Saharan Africa and Eastern Africa, does not have a right to actually use that language. It is not about competing resources. It is not about... It is about universality of rights. As much as gender affects us, and we resent the fact that we have not been included in that gender document, anal sex affects women, and there is an equal need for inclusion of anal sex in all kinds of prevention messages that goes out. Inclusion has to be from both ways. And that's what I appeal for, that it happens from both sides, that everybody takes into account what are the root causes of the problem and addresses those problems. It is not about my territory and your territory. It is not about my resources and your resources. It is about human rights. It is about the rights of every individual, man, woman, gay, non-gay, child, aged, transgender. It is about everybody to live with dignity. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hola. Soy Monse Pineda, de Creación Positiva, y bueno, quería agradeceros. ¿Me oyéis? ¿Sí? Quería agradeceros en primer lugar vuestras exposiciones. Quería solamente comentar una cosa, porque a veces pienso que cuando estamos hablando de género nos olvidamos de una dimensión importante, que lo habéis mencionado todos, que tiene que ver que para qué hablar de género. Y es, creo que es interesante no olvidar que lo que queremos es transformar el mundo. Porque si hablamos simplemente como una estrategia de mainstreaming, creo que no vamos a llegar al fondo. En realidad, lo que estamos hablando cuando estamos hablando de género es de desigualdad y de derechos humanos. Y yo creo que, como estabais aportando todas y todos, el objetivo es cómo reducir la desigualdad. Estamos hablando de un sistema absolutamente capitalista que hace que las mujeres y los hombres nos sigamos manteniendo en ese sistema. Lo digo porque, si no, a veces hablamos de cosas como conceptuales y, en realidad, estamos hablando de... Creo, ¿eh? Estamos hablando precisamente de cosas mucho más básicas, ¿no? Y con esas alianzas que estábamos comentando que podemos establecer, creo que no hay que olvidar que el objetivo último no es que entren en las políticas o como estabais planteando, ¿no? Sino transformar, que el mundo sea más justo, ¿no? Y sobre todo, pues, no solamente para las mujeres, sino también para los hombres. Quería comentar una cosa más, que es la necesidad de generar alianzas no solamente entre las personas seropositivas, sino entre los estamentos institucionales como UNIFEM, que vaya más allá, en todo caso, de una agenda política ligada exclusivamente a las conferencias internacionales, sino que tenga un trabajo posterior. Porque muchas veces vamos de conferencia en conferencia, nos encontramos las mismas personas y no hay una agenda, no hay un compromiso, ¿no? Y os pediría a las personas que sois responsables que realmente tengamos una agenda y que empecemos a pedir respuestas reales, ¿no? Porque yo creo que es el objetivo. Y empezar a poner las caras rojas a las personas que no están cumpliendo eso, con esos objetivos, porque si no, no solamente a nuestros hijos y a nuestras hijas vamos a dejar un mundo peor, sino que no vamos a dejarles un mundo. Y creo que nos merecemos algo, una respuesta global y una respuesta humana, ¿no? Gracias.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Thank you. Tim Shen from International Planned Parenthood Federation. Firstly, I want to thank all the panel very much for their fascinating and enlightening talk. And I also just want to make a couple of comments before I ask my question. I'm very pleased that in Mexico, you know, 2 years on from Toronto, where we had discussions on gender, we very much had discussions where gender was equating women and girls on the one hand, and then we had discussions about engaging men and boys on the other hand, that now we're having a panel where we're talking about gender and HIV, and we're taking a comprehensive approach to that. And I think that that's, it's a sign of the way in which the field is moving. I think it's a sign in which, you know, all of us should, you know, should congratulate the work that we're doing to get us to this place. And I also wanted just to also reiterate the comments that were made first and secondly in terms of the comprehensive approach to gender. From IPPS perspective, we were also concerned about the discussions around the UNAIDS guidelines. And I think particularly because, although we here collectively in this room recognise the essential nature of that comprehensive approach, it was very clear in that discussion that there were still many people who did equate gender just to be women and girls, and there was another camp on the other side who said, no, it's about sexual minorities. And I think, you know, in that sense, my question partly would be, you know, how do we move beyond this using the talents of all of us in this room, recognising that when we talk about gender, we do talk about all sexual minorities, women and girls, men and boys, transgender, gays. But how do we also do that in a way that meaningfully makes a difference on the ground in countries? And I have to say that, I mean, when from IPPS perspective, we are increasingly, through the Men Engage Alliance and other forums, looking at integrating men and boys into our work and pushing that agenda. But we're also cognizant of the fact that we don't want to move from swinging the pendulum from one side to the other, and that comprehensive approach needs to ensure that we engage men and boys from the one hand, but we don't in any way undermine the work of empowering women and girls and addressing the needs of sexual minorities. And I think in light of the comment that was said about the scarce resources on the ground, we do need to think, and I don't have the solutions now, but we do need to think comprehensively about how do we help countries on the ground to make sense of that process so that we can comprehensively address gender and not have to go through lots of different systems and processes to address every single different group. Thank you very much. But thanks again to the panel.
Thank you.
Thanks. I'm Susan Brennan from the YWCA. So my organisation's already had an opportunity to have its say, but I just wanted to add some comments, and I don't want to reopen a debate that people feel has been resolved, and I certainly don't want to misunderstand what may have already been said. But for me, the realisation of women's human rights isn't all about masculinity, which is what I heard you begin your remarks with. For me, women's human rights is at least significantly about the spaces, both physical and conceptual, within which women's leadership is developed. So I would be concerned if we put the construction of manhood at the centre of a gender analysis of our response to HIV. I think we have to be careful not to privilege one category over another, especially if we want to understand power and how power manifests itself. So equally, when we talk about a comprehensive approach, which is conceptually appealing, the experience of erasure and occlusion, which has historically been experienced by women, I think has to, is at least cautionary in the way we explore what a comprehensive approach means.
Thank you. Other comments? Aditya?
I want to address something that Gary Baker actually raised as a question, that can men change? And is it possible to change? And through that, maybe I also want to address the issue that you were raising here. Masculinity is actually the problem that we have to address. But the way that has been successful, like all the examples that Gary's presentation had, I think if we go back to those situations and analyze, those men have changed because women have been empowered. It is not disempowering men in those settings, which is actually like, you know, men have not given up their power. Men have accepted that women also have power. And that has come about because women have been empowered in those settings. And that's what we need to understand. It is about empowerment. And when we talk about empowerment, it is about empowerment because with empowerment of those who are today being oppressed, be it transgender, be it a gay man, be it a sex worker, be it a woman, by sex worker I'm including all kinds of sex worker, male, female and transgender. The power disparity is going to go away by empowerment of the disadvantaged and the oppressed. It is not going to go away by disempowering somebody who already has the power. And therefore it becomes necessary that in this gender document, which essentially will ultimately be about empowering certain sections of people, we include along with women, transgenders and sexual minorities who are also oppressed by that same masculinity, which is a problem. And in that context, masculinity not because like, oh, we want to give something more to the men who already have so much. It is not that. And unless we realize that problem, we're not going to make a dent in the whole situation. We can run about with our, like, you know, little pigeonholes, and we can run about with our little agendas, and we can, but one day we will be compelled, all of us, people who work on sexual minorities issues, people who work on women's issues, we will one day be compelled to come together and strategize together. Let us not, like, you know, waste time. Let's do it now. And that's all that I'm appealing for. Rather than try and protect our, like, you know, vested interests. Because ultimately, as somebody said, it was also about money. And there are limited resources and the money goes to all these different segments and pockets. And therefore, like, you know, we are, of course, competing for that resource. But it's ultimately not that we have to come together sometime in the future. Let us recognize the wisdom of that situation now and let us not waste time and do it now. That's all I'm saying.
Thank you. I think, okay, we'll take one more and then we'll let the panelists have a round of responses.
Okay, I hope I'm not going to bring more confusion here. I don't think the problem is men or women. I don't think the problem is about masculinity. I think the problem, the challenges we are having here is about socialization. How were we socialized in the first place? What makes me, you know, feel that I'm a man, and what makes another Fatima feel that she's a woman? You know, when you look at a tree, and I'm sure many of you know the problem tree, when you are, you know, digging, when you are looking at analyzing the situation, you know, from a tree perspective, you have the leaves. And most of our conversation here is about the symptoms. You know, we wanna fix challenges and problems from a technology perspective. It's not gonna work. We have the trunk and you have the roots. We are all part, you know, we are coming from a socializing process where we were taught, you know, who we are, our attitudes, our behaviors from stories most of the time. I think we need to go that far. We need to dig further to look at, hey, how were we socialized to become who we are, to have the attitude that we have and the behaviors that we have. And we need to go that far and not just, you know, stay at the level of dichotomy or separation or finger pointing.
Thank you. I'd like to ask if the panelists have comments. Gary?
Sure.
I think the important part that I would say is that maybe it's not masculinity we're talking about, but about patriarchy. And that what we mostly want to address are power inequalities. And that it seems that we've got enough accumulated experience about working on what we call gender to understand and to have a nuanced approach that's able to see gender as relational, that's able to see the multiple ways that power imbalances play out in the lives of girls and boys and men and women, both sexual minorities and otherwise. And I think if we can move beyond a view of gender that's either or and that recognizes how complex those power issues are, we'll get much further than trying to simply do some simple either or trying to overly simplify the issue. I think the work about transforming violent versions of masculinities and about transforming patriarchy is not in opposition to work in empowering women and girls. In fact, to us, ideologically and ethically, it's about doing that work together when that's possible. And I think in many cases we found that it can be possible. It's also not about setting it off to say there's work with heterosexual men over here and there's work with gay or bisexual men or transgendered men over here, but trying to find where we can do that together. That is easier to say than it is to do. But I think if we hold that up as a standard, that to me is about what this work is trying to be. Not small groups of men that feel good about working on behalf of gender equality, but about questioning those power imbalances. And I think we've come far enough on this field that we should be able to acknowledge that. I think the resource question is key, but I think it does get back to a question about either or. Is work with, and if I talk about the work with men and boys and trying to transform these gender inequalities, to me, when we're working at the community level, when we're working at the national level with coalitions of women's rights organizations to say, hold this work accountable, we want to do this in dialogue, I think we're much less likely to run into a situation where we say, the work that supports that is taking away from the work that's happening over here. Again, that's not always easy, but that's an ideal that we're trying to work toward. And I stressed how much we've been working on impact evaluation, not to say this program gets a bigger, you know, has a bigger sample size than that one and it showed greater evidence of behavior change than another, but to say we've got to hold ourselves up in a resource-scarce world to say, are these interventions and policy changes making a difference? And that's whether it's with a group of men over here, a group of women, or whether it's with sexual minorities or otherwise. We know of lots of work out there that's happening in the AIDS field that has very little evidence that it's causing much transformation. And I think we do have to hold ourselves accountable for that as an ethical and ideological issue. On the resource issue, I would love to see that instead of NGOs feeling like they're competing perhaps at some of the same sources, that we're trying to find some creative ways to draw funding for, I'd love to see ministries of defense funding this work. I'd love to see mining companies that cause tremendous damage because of the sex work that happens around them and sexual exploitation paying for the costs that are enjoined around there in addition to being able to arresting those who carry out the work. I think we've not been very creative about ways that we can build into tax structures and holding certain groups accountable for the harm caused by the patriarchy that's embedded in them. We've got lots of folks at the World Bank who think about ways of doing different forms of taxation that they're quite creative about. I don't think a lot of our gender work has done that. So it's not to say that those are going to be easy, but I do think we have to find ways that say, how can we hold those who benefit from that power accountable in some financial ways? That's going to take many, many years, but I think at least to try to say that out loud, could we be that creative?
Thank you. Nirudzai.
Couple of comments. I come from Africa, where when I say I come from Africa and I meet somebody in the corridor, they say, so do you know Fatima from Mali? I'll say, no, I'm from Zimbabwe. But you don't know Fatima? The assumption is that Africa is one country, that we are not 54 nations. So what has happened is the issue of vulnerable groups being lumped together in a way that does not facilitate a deeper creation of space, of analysis, of opportunity for intersection, for collective action, or for special action. What has been done is to have one sentence in most of our policy documents lumping vulnerable groups. Those vulnerable groups are then women, and the word used is even sexual minorities, not even naming the whole categories, and children, and persons with disabilities. I would recommend that from a policy point of view, both the United Nations and our governments, if we are to have a robust approach to HIV and AIDS, we can no longer hide the realities of the communities in their diversity and in their reality. Because as long as we cover Africa to be one country, it's the same as us saying vulnerable groups and a small budget. Africa negotiates as one country. We are 54 nations. Why should we negotiate as one region when we can also negotiate bilaterally or we can negotiate multilaterally? We need those options as communities and in our diversity. So I would recommend that we insist on the language emerging from this AIDS conference, that it is about a combination of prevention approach, a combination of treatment approach, and a combination of care approach, and that combination demands a recognition of diversity of realities. That is the first point, because that allows us to have space to be able to say, I can speak in whatever multiple identities I find myself, and my issues and the realities which make me vulnerable at risk can be addressed within the context within which I'm vulnerable. We need, therefore, the research institutions. This is a scientific conference. We need the scientific component of this program to also advance the research of diversities to vulnerability and not of vulnerable groups and their vulnerability. We need to disaggregate the realities of people's lives and then be able to have responses which address those realities. And I think we cannot accept the argument of money. Why? It's about choice. I sit in my house and make a decision on whether I should buy food for my children, or my husband can have an extra beer, or we should send a little bit to my in-law, or we should just buy something. It's about prioritization. So we would equally recommend that our governments, the international donors and partners, reprioritize the available resources in a way that responds to the realities of our diversity. We know the envelope is said to be small, but it's about prioritization. And we are saying that prioritization should include the issues that are crucial to the diversities that we find on the table. Again, it's about prioritization of HIV and AIDS versus what else. In most of our countries, the defense budget is a closed budget. It's not even discussed openly. A figure is announced. In most of our countries, the HIV and AIDS budget is externally funded, with very little funding coming from our national budgets. So it's not a question of resources not being available. It's a question of saying we can reduce military expenditure and put money to healthcare and to education and put money to food security. So, but because when the millions or billions were being mentioned, I was saying, so where is it going? So we need to look at the issue of resources as a political discussion. It's a policy discussion, it's a political discussion, because what we are dealing with when we deal with the vulnerable groups is the little cramps for a little workshop for the widows and orphans, when actually the real issue is not just about the widows and orphans. It's about what is causing that widowhood and what is the social response to ensuring that widows are not materially dispossessed when they are in widowhood, or widowers. We also know widowers who remain with nothing in my continent because my family comes and takes everything, and that man remains with nothing except his house, and they say his children, although it's both our children. So what I'm raising and what I would recommend is that we move the agenda from a little fight in the kitchen amongst ourselves and take the discussion to the living room where the policymakers are, where the money is, where the power is, and be able to say, you know, let's expand the space and let's expand and reshift the resources, because that is where the discussion is. And equally that we need specific tools. I would need a tool which defines how each category deals with the vulnerabilities which they especially experience, because the moment that issues are dealt with together, we don't go to the specificities of the actual vulnerabilities, because the document has to be 20 pages. Therefore, it's better for us to have 5 documents of 20 pages than for us all to be in 1 page and then not get the resources, not get the power, and the situation remains as it is. So I'm really recommending for a real political space for inclusion and for respecting our diversities.
Okay.
Thank you. I would just like to recall the experience that... I would like to recall the experience that we had in promoting family planning and male involvement and gender equity and the attempts that the world took in that relation. I wish the HIV world would learn from that. Secondly, I would like us to recall the experience of abortion. And here specifically, I would like us to reflect on the fact that in most of Africa, abortion is illegal. But what do we do to the people who've aborted willingly when they come to the health facilities? They are treated humanely, with dignity, and quickly, and correctly. The fact that MSM in Tanzania and other places is illegal may not necessarily be materialistic. It may not really matter. We don't need the president of Tanzania to say so for us to act. Because the experience of the world is that action takes place even where issues are not legalized. It takes a while. We need to advocate more than has been the case. Most of the time people assume everybody knows. They may not even know. So we need to do a lot more than what we are doing right now. We need to advocate more and more for equal opportunities regardless of your sex inclination, of your sexuality, regardless. In relation to inadequate resources, I have mixed feelings about that, because we are talking of countries. The most affected countries also happen to be relatively resource poor countries. We may never come to a point where we have adequate resources to say, yeah, there is enough to share between X, Y, and Z components of the world. So I think we need to learn as we are, as my former president said, to plan is to choose, prioritizing. Nyerere said, to plan is to choose. We have to prioritize the issues that we, as a human resource, see as priorities for our individual communities and address those with the limited resources. Because I doubt if we'll ever be at a time when we have enough resources for HIV, AIDS, for malaria, for tuberculosis, for diarrheal diseases, for measles, gender-based violence, and all. And they are all related.
Thank you very much. I'm actually really surprised that we have, I think, only about 4 minutes left. And I have been given the kind of very daunting task of summarizing this discussion. I think that what I would rather do is not summarize what the panelists have already said, because we all heard what they said, and they raised, each and every one of them, incredibly important points. And I want to thank all of you for your presentations. I think that the discussion that we've had over the past 40 or 50 minutes has been incredibly important and critical. I don't think that we have necessarily emerged from this satellite with the answers to all the questions. But I would like to make a couple comments of my own and then try to draw from the discussion what I think are some of the key points that you have shared. First of all, we've been talking all evening about gender guidance that is being developed by the UN system. It's not UNDP gender guidance. UNDP has the lead role within the UNAIDS family with regard to gender and human rights, and therefore they have taken the lead on the development of the guidance. The guidance document will emerge as a product of the UNAIDS family. And so it's just important to make that distinction, and it's important that everyone understand that this is, that while UNDP is carrying a major load of trying to navigate these rather stormy waters, this will be a product for the entire UNAIDS family. There has been reference in the discussion to the extremely heated and terribly divisive process that was related to the presentation of the gender guidance, the draft gender guidance, to the UNAIDS board in April of this past year. I think that Aditya is absolutely right that this division, especially the division between those groups who work on women's issues and those who work on issues for MSM, transgender, lesbian, gay, this has been the greatest tragedy of this process, that groups that actually believe in the same thing and want the same thing have found themselves battling. And I would also like to agree with you, Aditya, that I think that we in the UN system, it was a very complicated process, as you very well know, because you were involved in it. But we probably, definitely, could have managed that process better. It's always easy to say that in hindsight. What I can say now is that process has moved forward. For those of you who are not aware, the UNAIDS family was mandated to develop by our board two streams of guidance and tools. The board basically said to all of us, this is urgent. We need to move urgently on. The language of the PCB, of the board decision, was sexual minorities. We need to move urgently in that area, and we also need to move urgently in the area of women and AIDS. They stressed the urgency of the situation for both streams of work. They did break it down into two streams of work. We're now dealing with the fact that that actually it's not two streams of work, but as some people say, there are some reasons for dealing with it separately. At any rate, the board mandated us to move forward in two streams. I'd like to ask Susanna just to very briefly provide an update on where we are, especially with the sexual minorities guidelines.
Sure. Yes, we are, and as Kristen said, we are moving forward in two streams. On the one hand, we are somewhat further ahead in putting together a process for the guidance on women and girls. And at the same time, we are in the process of developing the process for what will be guidance on, as Kristen said, the language of sexual minorities. I think among all of us who are doing that work, we want some part of that discussion also to be about what's the language that we use. And I gave you our email address before and would welcome comments on that, and we will do our best to keep people informed as we go along with that. And let me also reiterate the point that Kristen made, is that this is a project of the UNAIDS family, and we are pleased to be able to play a role in helping keep that going and absolutely rely on this as a collective process, not just with the UN and AIDS family, but also among a broader community. And to that effect, we've also been putting together structures that will allow for that kind of broad consultation in both streams.
Thank you, Susanna. Just in the 2 minutes remaining, I would like to say that I don't think this kind of conversation could have happened a few years ago. I think that the heated debate that we've made reference to tonight has in some ways, I mean, it's been terribly painful for everyone, and it continues to be, but in some ways there's been a richness about it that has at least allowed us to come together in this kind of forum and raise these issues and take recommendations forward from this kind of forum. And we will, I can promise you that we will do that. There are also a number of other opportunities that we haven't really discussed tonight. On the issue of resources, we've heard some people tonight say that there aren't enough. We've heard other people say that there are enough and it requires a reprioritization. What's clear to me is that I don't even think we know how much we need. I mean, we are proposing that at the national level we know our epidemics, and I have a fear that this phrase "know your epidemic," which I happen to believe in, is going to soon kind of go the way of mantras that become meaningless. But we really, really need to dig much, much deeper. We need to really understand, as people have said, socialization processes. We need to really understand what makes all kinds of people, we need to really understand the diversities of the vulnerabilities. And when we really understand, we will then have a basis upon which to plan and upon which to budget. And then we will know how much money we need. But I personally totally agree with Nirudzai that this is going to require a shift in the way policymakers think at all levels, from the local to the most global level. We need to create the space where this kind of dialogue can actually be moved forward much more urgently and much faster. I was just reminded by Susanna that this process that we have been going through with the gender guidance, we have just said it's a UNAIDS family product, but UNIFEM has been quite heavily involved from the very beginning, and thank you very much for that, and thanks, Susanna, for that reminder. I think I'm going to stop there because we're out of time.
you all, I think, I hope, know where to find us. I hope that we can take forward some of the courage and the commitment that has been expressed in this meeting tonight over the next 4 days of this conference. Let us hear your voices. Let us all speak freely and openly, and let's continue to raise the very hard issues that you've raised tonight, and let's push the envelope because we have to. So thank you very, very much for your time.